Working Cows Podcast, episode 301. This episode is brought to you by Farming Without the Bank.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, recorded exclusively in the C90 Ocean Mineral Studios. And this episode is brought to you by Farming Without the Bank. None of you are ranching like you did 100 years ago. Why are you financing it like you did 100 years ago? The biggest part of your operation is the money that runs through your hands, and you let someone else control that. The bank gets the final say in what you get and when you pay it back. For many, this is a great relationship, until it's not. Farming Without the Bank shows you how you can take back control of your money so that you can make the bank plan B instead of plan A. This is done by you creating your own banking system that you own and control. To learn more, tune into the Farming Without the Bank podcast and go to farmingwithoutthebank.com to get the book. Once you've read the book, Mary Jo will meet with you one-on-one and help you determine where and how to get started. She will most likely also touch on some estate transition ideas, financing ideas, business growth or startup ideas, and many other things that she has experience with from helping thousands of farmers and ranchers. So go to farmingwithoutthebank.com today to get the book and subscribe to the Farming Without the Bank podcast now. Very excited to be joined by a longtime friend of the podcast. Daniel Hayes and I have yet to meet in person, but we look forward to that eventuality someday. I saw that Daniel was getting into dogs more and more through social media, some of the posts that he's been putting up there. And we have recently acquired a dog that we hope will be a working dog, a dog that can help us move pairs in a low stress way, or yearlings or whatever we happen to be moving, just hoping that they will help us to accomplish those goals more efficiently and effectively. And Daniel is just gotten into these things and had some really good mentors and had some really good legs up along the way. And I wanted to talk to him about some of the things that he's been learning in this journey. So Daniel, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Thanks, Clay. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, long time. I don't know if I can call you friends, never having met you face to face, but I've always appreciated the opportunities we've had to connect over the phone and some of those things. And your support of the podcast over the years now has been very meaningful to me and my family. So thank you so much.
I've been on this ride with you since almost the very beginning, I think. And it's been really cool to watch what you've done and what God's done through your podcast. So it's been a blessing to be able to be a little part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it has been a pretty wild ride. I've said this too recently, but I'll say it again in the meat of an episode that I've been uploading there's been an automated process of uploading the back catalog of the Working Cows podcast to YouTube, because YouTube is apparently dipping their toes into the podcast world, and I just want to be there if they're going to launch it in earnest. I want to have my stuff there. And so it's been kind of fun, but also kind of cringy to hear some of those early episodes and go, ooh, yeah. But I'm sure, if Lord willing, if I'm still doing this in another 5 years, I'll listen to stuff now and think, oh, That wasn't that good either, but it's been fun growing, just continuing to grow and learn. So that's been really, really good. Been a good journey for me. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk to you about as well, is kind of your journey into agriculture generally, and then stock dogs specifically. And so we can start wherever you want. We can start with the agriculture in general, or we can start with the stock dogs and then talk about the agriculture later. However you want to get started, I think that's where I'd like to head for today.
We started out with a few cows And I very quickly learned I was not going to be profitable or even be able to afford to do that, just taking calves to the sale barn with, you know, 7 or 8 mama cows. And so we switched to trying to do some direct marketing, and we were relatively successful with that. We had a USDA label, and we were selling steaks and roasts and hamburger and all that, and we could sell individual packages. Then I got to the point where when I needed help, there wasn't always somebody to help me. And I was like, it'd be really nice to have a dog that could do this. And so we got into the dogs and needed some sheep to train the dogs on, and pretty quickly realized that my 12 sheep were making me just as much money as the 8 cows, and that I could run a lot more sheep if I just got rid of the cows. And I remember specifically listening to an episode with Derek Schwanebeck, where he talked about his Corianni cows and how he really liked the Red Angus Corianni crosses, but that he knew it wasn't the best path to go on and the way he was going to be able to, you know, be the most successful and have the lifestyle that he wanted. And I was like, well, if Derek can let go of that, maybe I ought to, you know, switch over. So we sold the cows, we finished the steers we had, and switched over to sheep completely. And the dogs have just grown from there. We got into doing sheepdog trials, which is, it's a lot of fun. And it's a good way to showcase your dogs and that kind of thing. Get people to, you know, notice if you've got a nice dog they might want to pup out of or something like that. And also hoping to train some dogs for other people. I've got a few dogs that are here now that are, I'm either training to sell or training for somebody else. So that's kind of where we're at.
Sure. So yeah, tell me a little bit about where in the world you are as far as your geographic and ecologic context.
So we're in Belton, South Carolina, which is a little south of Greenville, would be the biggest city. We're 2 hours south of Charlotte, 2 hours north of Atlanta. It's a pretty suburban area. So we have a lot of small cattle operations. Maybe 20, 25 cows would be the norm around here. But there's absolutely, I wouldn't say there's no row crop agriculture, but it's mostly hobby guys. And there aren't very many cattle operations of any real size.
Is the landscape kind of mostly broken up by trees? Is it open? Is it rolling hills? What's the landscape like?
We're in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, so we've got a lot of trees. And anything that's not deciduous forest has been cleared for pasture or crops back in the day.
Sure. What would that be? What was it when it was cleared? It was deciduous forest when it was cleared, or what was it before it was cleared?
Yeah, it would have been deciduous forest.
Sure. Gotcha. And so not large chunks of land, but productive. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, we can run a cow on about 2 acres here. We get a lot of rain. Mostly Kentucky 31 fescue would be the most common grass around here. And that's good in some ways and bad in some ways. You get all the problems with endophyte and all that, but you also have a grass that pretty much keeps growing 365 days a year here, and can produce a lot of hay. And we have a lot of pretty cheap hay around here too. There's a lot of guys who seem to do that kind of recreationally.
The endophyte, is that something that shows up more during certain times of the year, or is it there all the time, or how does that work?
From what I've been told, it's mainly concentrated in the seed heads. And we typically have to clip pasture to keep it fresh. So usually about mid-May we'll bush hog to kind of set everything back to a vegetative state. And I don't see any real, I haven't seen any real issues with my cows when I had cows. I haven't seen a whole lot of issues with my sheep, but our weaning weights are nothing like you guys get out west, or people get on, you know, Bermuda or something like that. So I think mainly what we see is just smaller calves. But we don't have, you know, cows with fescue foot or tails falling off or anything like that, or at least I haven't personally.
And is that a native grass then to your area, or was it anywhere?
No. I'm not sure where it comes from, but it's definitely what they call an improved pasture species.
Gotcha. Similar to our crested wheat then. And so probably early growing and outcompetes everything else and just kind of takes over.
It's a battle. Every year I say, oh, I want to try to keep up with it so I don't have to bush hog it. But I have yet to even come close.
Yeah. Good problem to have, right? I grow too much grass. So,
right. Yep.
At least it sounds like it anyways, where I'm from. And
yeah,
so,
and
yeah, go ahead.
I've thought about going out and, you know, bringing in a bunch of steers. I mean, a bunch on my scale, I'm talking maybe 20, and grazing it real hard and try to keep up. But then, you know, are you going to get the gains in that 2 month window where it's really booming like that to make it, you know, worth all that trouble? And I haven't convinced myself it's worth it yet.
So you got started in agriculture with the cows, realized that the sheep were a profitable critter and the dog was helpful with the sheep. Is that kind of the outline so far?
Yeah. I got very excited about getting to work with the dogs. It fits with my brain pretty well. As far as, I think I'm a bit like a border collie, maybe a little bit obsessive and have trouble thinking about anything but what I really want to think about. And so I think I can relate to them pretty good. And getting to do two things that I like at once. I tell my wife as we're setting up net fence a lot, there's two things that I get really excited about. And that's, you know, rotational grazing, where I'm getting to harvest forage and watch this one little area that I'm choosing and get to turn that into sheep in our case. And then the other thing is, you know, getting to train dogs and seeing a puppy that for us, we whelp in our bathroom. So I get to see this, you know, pup that was born in our bathroom and get to watch it grow up until it's 10 months old. And then get to see these instincts that God put into these dogs and be able to harness those and be able to turn that into a dog that can do some really, really amazing things. And sometimes, you know, people come, we sell a lot of our sheep to smaller homestead kind of people who want three or four ewes, and you do something with your dog, just loading the sheep on the trailer. And they're like, wow, that's amazing. It's like, these dogs can do some stuff that's way cooler than that. If you just, give them the time and the opportunity.
So what got you started with dogs? I mean, it was the seeing the need for the sheep and the tool that the dog was, but what was kind of your introduction to it? Where did you first come in contact with the dogs as a tool?
So I went out and I bought a little Australian Shepherd heeler mix puppy, and I tried to go to some lessons to get her trained. And I got to meet my friend Brian, who's he and my friend Carol Ann have really helped me out a ton on this process. And I got to take that dog, and he kind of showed me, and he said, you know, this dog, you can teach it to do your chores. He said, but it's going to take 10 times longer with this dog, and it's not going to end up being able to do nearly the things that a border collie could do. And so that was kind of my introduction. And
so was that dog limited because of his genetics?
Yes. It's really interesting to see the way that we train border collies is vary based on what they're going to naturally do. Like for instance, I don't really worry about teaching a dog a down until the dog actually gives me a down, because there's a certain situation where the vast majority of border collies are just going to naturally lie down when you have sheep that are moving away, and then maybe you stop and the dog's clear that they're not going to be able to move any further that way. Maybe you're up against a panel or up against a wall. The dog's just natural reaction is to lie down. And so you pop a word onto that and you say, lie down. And after four or five repetitions, the dog kind of puts that language to that action. And the same with our directional commands, the standard being come by and away to me. The dog's natural tendency is to want to control chaos. And so we're just changing the direction and then putting that word to it. Now, other breeds have different ways that they want to work. And so it's, at least with my experience with Aussies and Heelers, that innate desire to circle stock isn't as pronounced. And so these things that we've looked to and put words to that are just kind of how we train dogs. And there could be Aussie trainers and Heeler trainers out there that have their own methods that fit better with those breeds. I'm definitely not claiming to know everything. But Border Collies just fit with the way that we've developed to train dogs very well.
Sure. And do you think that one breed over another will kind of lend itself more towards a low stress approach to handling stock?
I think it's very dependent on the dog. I have 12 Border Collies right now, and some of them are pups. But I have one dog that no matter what, I know he can go out and get anything done, but it might not be pretty and it might not be under control. And that dog doesn't go to dog trials anymore because he may have made a fool of me a couple times. I have another dog that does everything that I tell him to do, but if I don't tell him exactly how to do it, he may not get the job done. So he looks to almost be like a remote control dog, versus my other dog thinks for himself a lot. And the one who does exactly what I tell him to do, I can definitely get things done in a much more low stress manner. And so I think even you're asking about differences between different breeds, but I think even between different border collies and different ways that people have bred them, I think you can see a big difference and what's going to lend itself towards low stress handling. The border collie breed has become so diverse. There are dogs that have been bred for agility, dogs that have been bred for pets. And then we even are starting to see a more it's been a while, but more of a cattle line and more of a sheep line. But in my opinion, there's a smaller group of dogs that can do both very well. And typically the dogs that are trained to be sheep dogs that will also work cattle are the ones who are going to get things done more accurately and with less stress on the animal. I see a lot of the cowbred dogs and you watch them on videos on the internet and they're hanging off noses maybe when they don't need to. And dogs are not cheap. A trained dog is a big investment. And sometimes I watch people and they're just sending their dog into bad situations to show how tough they are. And personally, if my dog can get things done from a little further back and maybe we take a little extra time and leave a few extra pounds on the steers and don't risk getting my dog stomped on, that seems a little bit preferable to me. But also when my dog hangs on a nose, I get excited. So I definitely understand that.
Yeah. Has your kind of your journey into Border Collie specifically then been mostly in relationship to your community and the people that you kind of encountered first, and they were the ones who said, you know, we can train this shepherd healer cross, but it'll take longer, and you probably won't ever be as effective as you would be with a border collie. And so they were border collie people, and that's kind of what drew you to them.
Yes, absolutely. And then, you know, they took time with me. They still take time with me and answer all my questions whenever I have questions. And I think that's, if you're trying to get into this, I think that's the best thing for you to do is find a mentor. And even buy a pup from that person, because they're going to know how their dogs work best. So find somebody that you like how they do things. You like their dogs, and then listen to them. I say a lot of the time, especially with my friend Brian, I used to try to do things my own way, and then I'd have to go back and do it his way that he told me to begin with. And so now when somebody asked me, you know, why are you doing that like that? I say, because I'm tired of telling Brian he's right all the time, and that I should have just done it his way to begin with. So yeah, I think that's the best way to go. And different dogs, you know, need to be trained differently. And so if you buy a dog from that person, they kind of already know how their dogs think. They kind of know what works best for those dogs. And, you know, some dogs, you tell them something one time and they latch onto it and they're great. But those easy teachable dogs, sometimes they can learn things you don't want them to learn quickly too, whether that be a bad habit or whether they get kicked in the head and they decide they're not going to bite a heel anymore. Sometimes the more stubborn dogs, they take a little more work to begin with, but they end up being better in the long run. So, you know, the trainer slash breeder is going to know what works best for their dog. As far as some dogs need you to be a little more hard on them, and some dogs, you know, they don't take much correction at all.
Sure. What are some of the other sources of mentorship that you've found useful or invaluable that you've that you've really found? This is something that I need to expose myself to.
I found a Patreon with a guy named Paddy Fanning, which is Churchmount Sheepdogs, and he's over in Ireland, and he's got a real nice dog named Bruce that he's competed in the international with a few times, I believe a few times, and done very well in the Irish national, if not won it. I believe he may have even won it. He puts a lot of videos up, and I think it's maybe $30 a month or something like that, and you can access his whole video library. That's been very helpful. But most of what I've learned has been experiential or directly from someone teaching me.
Let's take a break and hear from our sponsor today, Farming Without the Bank. None of you are ranching like you did 100 years ago. Why are you financing it like you did 100 years ago? The biggest part of your operation is the money that runs through your hands, and you let someone else control that. The bank gets the final say in what you get and when you pay it back. For many, this is a great relationship, until it's not. Farming Without the Bank shows you how you can take back control of your money so that you can make the bank plan B instead of plan A. This is done by you creating your own banking system that you own and control. To learn more, tune into the Farming Without the Bank podcast and go to farmingwithoutthebank.com to get the book. Once you've read the book, Mary Jo will meet with you one-on-one and help you determine where and how to get started. She will most likely also touch on some estate transition ideas, financing ideas, business growth or startup ideas, and many other things that she has experience with from helping thousands of farmers and ranchers. So go to farmingwithoutthebank.com today to get the book and subscribe to the Farming Without the Bank podcast now.
Yeah, what have been some of those lessons that you've learned, some of the things that you have found, you know, kind of necessary to understand and know as you have been on this journey into using sheepdogs?
There are a lot of people out there that say things like, oh, you don't want a dog that that ever quits, or you don't want a dog that ever backs away from stock. Let me just say that puppies do a lot of things. And, you know, especially if you're starting dogs younger, maybe like a 6-month-old puppy, he's a baby. And we don't know what he's going to be at that point, you know? And so I had all these thoughts in my head. If a dog ever shows, you know, a little bit of weakness or whatever, that's not the dog for you. But, you know, there is a certain level of confidence that they can build up. And there are definitely dogs that aren't tough enough to get jobs done and that kind of thing. But there are a lot of dogs that are going to grow into who they're going to be a little bit later. Personally, I don't really mess with dogs much before they're even 10 months old, which is something that I've seen. I've tried starting them at 8 months. I've tried starting them at 7 months, and I typically end up putting them back up. Another thing is you really, and I know, I think it was David Neeson said on his, you can take anything you want out of these dogs with the heel of your boot, but you can't ever put anything back into them. And so it's really important to not yell at them for things that you're going to want them to do later. We don't have cats and we don't have chickens because it was just too many opportunities to have to yell at a dog for something I was going to want them to do later. And of course, there's a place for recall and being able to tell a dog how to harness that and all that. But personally, I'm going to figure that out once I've already given them that outlet that they want, as far as working sheep. Then we'll worry about specifying, hey, we work sheep, we don't work cats, we don't work chickens or whatever. And even today, we've got one goat that randomly showed up, literally a stray goat that showed up on our place. And I sent my dog to move him out of a pen, and it was like 12 sheep and one goat. And she left the goat, and I even tried to send her back, and she was like, that's not a sheep, idiot. Like, we're not working that. And so they do know a difference. You know, take your puppy once a month. Show them some sheep, let them have a great time. Don't yell at them for anything. If they bite the sheep and cause a mess, that's your fault. They're a champion when you're done. Let it be fun. Have a rope on them so you can catch them easily and you don't have to chase them around. Don't get frustrated. You know, make it as fun for them as possible, but don't overexpose them to stock. Don't let them chase your cows. Don't let them get kicked in the head. Personally, I think everybody should probably start out with a started dog just because it's so hard when you're excited about your first puppy. It's so hard to leave them in the kennel when you should. And it's, you know, you want them with you. You want to bond with them. That's important. But what's more important is that they don't pick up those bad habits and that you don't have to get on to them for doing what they're born and bred to do. And I think, you know, you go out, you buy a 12-month-old dog that's already shown that it's going to go both ways and walk up and lie down and all that. I think there's a big advantage to that. And you get to skip the 10 months of waiting and hoping and, oh, what if this particular dog doesn't turn on or what if it's no good and all that? Because I've seen dogs out of, you know, world champion, international supreme bloodlines that just didn't work. They just had other things that they'd rather do. And there's no guarantees. So there's definitely an advantage to getting something that's already showing that they want to be a sheepdog. And it's really cool to get to be there for that moment when they make that decision. Cause there definitely is a moment where you see them, you know, at first they're a pup and they're just running around sheep, but then one day they're like, okay, I'm serious about this. Like, you know, what do I need to do to get to keep doing it? But again, you know, you got to weigh that with the risk of what if you get a pup that doesn't turn on, or I had a pup that got to 9 months old and got ran over. So there's all kinds of risks in puppies, but started dogs are a good way to go if you can afford that financial investment.
Sure. And so that was my next question, is kind of a dog's life cycle as far as how you look at it. And so I'll just summarize what you said with regard to life cycle, and then you can add whatever else you think is necessary there. But kind of minimal exposure on a long leash as a puppy to animals, and not much discipline, or don't discipline them, like you said, for something you're going to want them to do later, and they're a champion when they get done. And then in about 10 months, there's kind of a 2-month training period that they'll go through until they're about a year, and then they're ready to go somewhere else as a started stock dog. What else would be kind of that you would want to add to that life cycle that I kind of summarized there?
Different dogs are going to take different amounts of time. My Rook dog that I'm real excited about, you tell her something once and then you put her in her kennel, and I seriously think that she sits there and thinks about it all night. And, you know, she makes a mistake and you tell her that she was wrong. And then the next day she goes out and she doesn't do that ever again. Now I've got a litter mate sister to her, and you're going to have to tell her 15, 20 times before it ever gets through her head. And they're both good dogs, and they're both, I'm real, real, real proud of both of them. But it just takes different amounts of time for different dogs. So that 2 months, it may be longer, it may be shorter, and it also depends on what you want out of your dog. For a sheepdog trial, it's going to take a good bit longer than that to get everything we're going to need on them to be that precise, because, you know, you've got your dogs around here out 300 yards or so on an outrun, and you're asking them to stop and redirect the sheep and that kind of thing out that far. And from what I've heard out further west, those outruns are even longer than that. I've heard stories about people saying that you couldn't even see the sheep from where you started out. We don't have the terrain for that here. I don't know of anywhere that you can even see that far around here. But for just like a farm dog, who you're not going to need to be able to push stock away from you, you're just going to need them to bring stock to you, you can get there pretty quick, two, maybe 3 months with a dog who's trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, I am a prairie kid for sure. I drove to Pennsylvania one time, and about Ohio, I started getting claustrophobic with all the trees that were practically touching over the 4-lane interstate. And yeah, it was a new experience for sure. But, that is definitely a difference. But yeah, I appreciate that. I think that's a good summary. And I'd like to, you know, go where you've touched on a couple of times as well, is the idea of sheepdog trials and some of those things. And I've gotten in trouble for making this comparison or touching on this subject before, but I don't care. So I will go there again, that sometimes when we start doing something in a competitive fashion, the concern or the stockmanship part of it can sometimes go out the window, and we only worry about getting it done fast. And case in point is rodeo. You know, in a rodeo scenario, it's all about the clock. It's not about, you know, cortisol and heart rate and any of those things in the livestock. And so I didn't know, is there any of that in the sheepdog trials, or do you think that it's a good balance of competition and, because fast is the, or slow is the new fast, you know, from a stockmanship perspective, that those things do fit together a little bit better in that scenario?
I think it was on here that Bob Kinford talked about the putting a heart rate monitor on steers and having a pin rider competition.
Yep.
Sheepdog trials, there are two kinds of trials. By far the most common kind is a judged trial. And in a judged trial, what they're looking for is that you don't upset the sheep and that you use straight lines. So when sheep get upset, they typically don't go the direction you want them to. And so they're going to swerve around. You're going to have to redirect your dog a good bit. So it's it's extremely important to make sure that you keep the sheep as calm as possible. Additionally, sheep, you're not allowed to bite typically in a sheep trial unless the sheep attacks the dog in some cases, or if the sheep are just completely refusing to move. But mostly if your dog bites or grips, you're going to get disqualified. So it's very important to not get the sheep worn out and upset, because, you know, when sheep are tired, when sheep are wormy or sick or feel threatened, they either run or they turn around and fight. And so I remember one trial in particular, a sheep turned around and walked backwards for a good bit of the run. And finally my dog said, "All right, you need to turn around and hit her on the nose." And I asked the judge, you know, what he'd thought. And he said, "Well, you know, if your dog had been a little further back from the beginning, she may have never turned around on you." He said, your dog did the right thing, but your dog got disqualified. And that dog's a great farm dog. And if he didn't do that in that case, he wouldn't be able to do things that I need him to do now. But even in that situation, just from the point we picked the sheep up, we needed to keep them a little more calm and have them feeling a little less threatened, so that we didn't get in a situation where we had to be more aggressive with them. So I think that's one of the coolest things about sheepdog trialing is, usually you have a time limit, but it's usually plenty of time to get what you need to do done. And so it's not about doing things as fast as possible. It's about doing things as smoothly as possible. There are also what you call time and points trials. And those are, you know, you hit the obstacle, it doesn't matter how you got there. And those, usually the time is just a tiebreaker. So even in those cases, it's still way better to hit the obstacles, take your time, than it is to hurry. And, you know, so I think that's one big advantage that sheepdog trialing has over being a realistic teacher of stockmanship, than maybe seeing how fast you can milk a wild cow.
And that's a ranch rodeo, and that's got applications to everyday ranch life, for sure. But
and don't get me wrong, I love watching ranch rodeo.
Yeah, for sure. Me too. So would you say that people who have a farm dog, a dog that they're just asking to work day in, day out, would be more successful on the farm if they took that dog and competed with them in sheep dog trials from time to time? Or do you think that those two worlds are separate enough that it's really not worth, the juice isn't worth the squeeze, so to speak?
I think that if they went into it, they would have a big advantage over people. There are people that got dogs because they have sheep, and then there are people that got sheep because they have dogs. And there are people that got sheep because they have dogs that will stomp me into the ground and are way better handlers than I am. But there's definitely an advantage to already understanding how livestock think, and what the dog needs to be doing to accomplish the goal that you have. It's just one less thing you have to learn. Cause you're already thinking about training your dog. You're already thinking about, you know, getting the sheep around the course, and having that be something that's a little more innate to you is definitely helpful. So having a little bit of a stockmanship background is a big advantage. Whether it would be beneficial for those people to go out and trial to become a better handler, it's a different world, because usually we're talking three sheep, four sheep, at least in our trials. I know there are trials that run larger groups. Moving three sheep's a good bit different than moving 200 or 300, and working in close proximity and pens and that kind of thing is a lot different than moving around a trial field. So there are differences. I think the biggest advantage is if you have a great dog and you really want to sell pups out of it, or you really want to, you know, want other people to want to use it as a stud dog, they're not going to know about it if he's just doing the work around your place every day. And trials are a good opportunity to show people what you've got genetically. So yeah, I think that's one of the biggest advantages of it is, you know, people get to see dogs and see what they like and that kind of thing.
So talk to me through kind of your business model as it relates to sheepdogs and what you guys are doing, what kind of sweet spot you're trying to hit as far as your target market and how you're trying to raise dogs that kind of hit that target.
I love getting to be able to put dogs in the hands of people that are going to use them every day. Where we're at, that doesn't happen a whole lot. So we have a lot of people who dog trial and that kind of thing. We have, and they have to go somewhere and rent sheep to just be able to train on, cause they don't have space or whatever at home. I really like being able to put dogs into a situation where they're going to get to really use their skills to make somebody's life easier. I cannot imagine having sheep and not having a dog. And I know you do that, at least your dog's a pup right now.
Yep.
But I just, you know, I don't typically have to worry about if I get a call and the sheep are out, it's very quickly handled. And if I need to get sheep on a trailer or whatever, there's never a worry about if we can get it done. I just grab my dog and we go. And being able to change somebody's life like that's definitely a help. I've got a guy that we're selling a started dog to, and we're going to go down and, you know, train his dog a little bit at his place and all that. And he runs what to me is a pretty big operation, and I'm excited for him to have a, you know, a helper who's 5 times faster than he is and has a different effect on sheep than a person walking does, for sure. And that's really, really cool to get to see somebody and help somebody like that. So ideally I'd love for all my dogs to go to working homes. We do end up with some of our dogs going to people that are more pet oriented or even sport oriented. We've got a lot of agility, and a lot of what makes a dog good as a working dog also makes them a good agility dog or a good frisbee dog. Being able to, you know, just want to do one thing and do it well all the time. So we'll produce 2 to 3 litters of puppies this year. I also sometimes buy puppies that I like and start them. And I keep some puppies off of my litters and start them as well. And we do try to sell some started dogs, so that's 2 different outlets. And then, you know, as you get dogs that you can only keep so many, at least that's what they tell me. And so when you get a dog that's maybe better than the dog that you've got currently, sometimes, eventually we'll want to move those on as well. Finished dogs, started dogs, and pups are basically kind of the categories, I guess.
Sure. Is there something that draws you to a puppy, or is it his parents and his, you know, the operation he comes from? Like you said, you like to buy puppies that you like. Is it just the parents that they're out of, or what draws you to a puppy?
Definitely seeing most people in the border collie world will let you use their male. And so if you see a male, you can go out and breed your female to it typically and just pay a stud fee. So typically the really top males get used by people in the trial world. And so when you see a female that you like and you've seen around, and then you see that getting bred to a male that matches her really well, has similar qualities to her and doesn't have the same weaknesses. I've been told it's important to breed like to like. You don't want to breed a dog who's got a very aggressive working style to a dog that's got a, you know, more laid back, what we'd call a wide dog that stays off things maybe a little too much. You can't just fix that by breeding a really tight dog and a really wide dog. You're not going to end up with dogs that go down the middle of the road. You're going to end up with one or the other. So if you've got a dog you like, look for a male that's similar to that dog and breed that way rather than trying to fix faults. Try to complement what you've already got. And so when you see a litter that's like that, that would be something that definitely attracts me. And again, like I said, there's something to be said for buying dogs from the people that are going to be helping you, because that's you making a little bit of an investment in them. And at the same time, that's them having a little idea what your dog's going to be like out of the gate, because they're experienced with that bloodline in particular.
Sure. A couple of terms you used there were started versus finished. And I think we've talked about a started dog is, you know, somewhere around a year old that's been working for a couple of months. Since it turned 10 months old, what would be a finished dog in your vocabulary, and about how old would they be?
Ooh.
Are they ever finished?
That's a good question. I think Drake's about to be 4, and I've got a female named Linda that's probably 5, and there's still things I definitely want to work on with both of them. So I think finished, we'd say, you know, they're driving well, which pushing stock away from you. And I would say probably shedding, which is where we're taking a group of sheep and splitting certain sheep off or dividing the group into half or something like that. Maybe let's say there's 4 sheep. The judge will tell you to separate them and keep the back 2. And that's kind of usually the last thing before people are competing in open, which is our highest level of competition. And this is all based on USBCHA, which is United States Border Collie Handler Association, which is what we compete in. And that would be the last thing that kind of separates a dog who's not ready to run in open from a dog that is. So I'd say if they're shedding and, you know, they're already, you know, able to complete an open level course. But as far as a farm dog, I'd say when they're doing what you need them to do, they're finished as far as you're concerned.
What's your range as far as where would you send a pup? How far away? I mean, we're talking to people in all 50 states. You're in South Carolina. How far away would you be willing to send a pup, or how do you guys think about those things?
I've got a litter on the ground right now, and one of those pups is going to Washington State and one's going to California. So we'll send them wherever they need to. I think the guy from California is actually just going to fly out here and we're going to meet him at the airport. Yeah, we definitely don't have a problem getting them to wherever they need to go. Something I'm really interested in is doing a raise and train program eventually. Because I see so many people with their first puppy doing things that they maybe shouldn't be doing. I think, you know, if you had a situation where somebody could put their name on a puppy and even pay for that puppy up front, and then just leave it with the breeder to raise it the way they raise puppies, and then, you know, train them once they get to an appropriate age, and then take that puppy to the person that's getting it, work that dog with that person, show them, you know, how this dog works and that kind of thing, and then put that dog in some situations where it's going to live with that owner, with the person who trained them there to kind of help out. I think that's the best way for that to happen. And I haven't really put a ton of thought into that, but that's just been something I've always thought would be really, really helpful for people that are getting started. And it'd be a lot of fun because it'd be that you're actually helping somebody and making somebody's life easier, not just sending them a puppy and telling them to figure it out.
Yeah, you've alluded to it a couple of times throughout this episode, but you know, we talked a little bit about your evolution, the evolution of your livestock business, and going from cows to sheep, and then getting the dogs as a helper in that sheep operation. But what are some of the things that you guys are able to do now, and that you are doing as far as the sheep operation is concerned, that the dogs are so helpful with?
We're able to graze places that other people can't graze. Most of the lease land around here is, you know, a guy who's older and has had that place for a while. And if he ever quits, it's his buddy that gets it or whatever. And so most of the places with fences and water infrastructure are already being taken care of. But with the increase in diesel prices and the cost of making hay, and the cost of bush hogging, we've had some opportunities to take places that don't have fences and don't have water infrastructure. And right now, I'd say my biggest limiting factor is I need more sheep, and I need a portable shade structure that I can afford. I've talked to some of the people that make those things, and they're a little bit out of my budget right now. So I'm trying to come up with some portable solutions that I can provide shade when it's 105 degrees out with, you know, extremely high humidity to 100 sheep at a time or something like that. That's my biggest limiting factor as far as expanding my sheep operation, is just the time waiting on ewe lambs to grow up and shade, because there's so many places around here that either the grass is just growing up and rotting, or is getting bush hogged, and you know, we're spending money to keep it looking pretty. And I could pretty easily do that with sheep without having to burn any diesel. So that's really something the dogs help with, because, you know, we can move paddock to paddock. If the sheep get out, it's not a big deal. If we're moving from place to place, we can load trailers quickly and easily with no infrastructure. We're 100% portable. If the people where my sheep are right now called me and said, get your sheep out of here, I could be out of there in 2 hours. And the only thing would be figuring out how to get my ground rods out of the ground. Would be the only difficult part. We haul water in every day or every other day. If we don't need to, we don't obviously do it. But the only thing that would be left if we had to get out of there is sheep manure and ground rods right now. So that's pretty cool. And we're not paying anything to graze that place. Mm-hmm. They're extremely wonderful people. And they apologize to me if they have to call and say something's out. Like they're inconveniencing me, and I'm like, you're doing me a huge favor. I don't mind you calling me, and I'd rather you call me than not call me. But that's an opportunity that we wouldn't have with cattle. We're pretty close up to their house. And, if cows got out and got in the road or got in their yard, that would be a much bigger deal than sheep. And then the difference between hauling water in for sheep and hauling water in for cattle is exponential. I used to run a 600 gallon tank for 8 mama cows and their calves, and I run 200 gallon tanks for, there's 100 sheep over there. And we run hair sheep, so they are on the smaller side. Everything's a Katahdin base, and then we run a Dorper ram over top of that. And we're doing some experimenting with the Romanovs, kind of doing what the Mark Meat Animal Research Center did with the Easy Cares, except my Dorper's a blackhead Dorper and not a white Dorper. So we're trying to get that lambing percentage up a little bit higher by getting the Romanov influence in there.
Sure. And what other temporary infrastructure are you using? You talked about the water and hauling it in. What else is kind of the key to that operation as far as temporary infrastructure? Because there's no permanent infrastructure there, right?
Right. Yeah. It's if they get out, they're out.
They're on the road.
Interestingly, my house is about a mile from where the sheep are right now. And I bought a couple ewes from a friend and brought them home. And one of them, I'd never seen a sheep act like this, but she just took off and didn't stop. And she ended up, my mom saw her run by their house, which is down a gravel driveway from us. And we didn't find that ewe for 3 days. And then she showed up where my sheep were a mile away, just trying to find sheep. So she was walking down the middle of the road, and somebody called me and said, your sheep are out. And I was like, well, that sheep isn't even supposed to be over there. She's supposed to be at home. But we use a lot of, Premier One net fencing. I love that stuff. And I hated it when I first got it because I tried to roll it up. I didn't fold it like they tell you to. They really know what they're talking about. Because if you learn to work with that stuff the right way, it's very easy. I don't think there's many things I do that are more relaxing than putting that stuff up, as long as you don't have to go through any brush. But I love just being out in the middle of a big pasture and just setting net fence up. We use that, and we use a battery powered charger. I don't even have a solar panel on it. I just change the battery every 2 days and bring it home and charge it. And I'm working on some ideas for shade, but we haven't come up with a great solution for that. So when it gets real hot, we have to fence them into the woods and kind of, you know, have a part of the fence that extends into the woods. But then, you know, they're grabbing all those nutrients and taking them and sticking them in the woods. And that really bothers me. And I know I'm not utilizing my forage as well as I could be if I was keeping my paddock tighter. So I have to make my paddocks longer so that they'll reach back into the woods. And so we don't get the, you know, kind of frenzy effect that makes them eat the stuff that they don't want to eat as much. And I do see a big difference when the paddocks are bigger. So that the shade would be a big help with that as well. So that's my next thing to figure out.
Yeah. People would find this hard to believe until they worked with it, but I know for a fact that I've spent more time untangling poly wire reels than I have spent untangling Premier One net fencing. That is no doubt in my mind.
Especially the geared reels.
Yep. Yes, because you get moving fast and things go wrong, and then they go really wrong really fast.
if it moves fast, it also gets tangled fast.
Right. Yeah. So one of my board members here at church, he trains colts for a living, or one of the things that he does is train colts, and he said one time he was explaining to me a technique for working with a horse, and he said, now this is a big tool, and big tools make big mistakes really fast.
So, yeah
very good, Daniel. I really appreciate your time today. Anything else that needed to get said here today on this topic?
No, I don't think so. I'm real appreciative to you for all the time that you've put in on the podcast and all the resources that's put in front of me. I've bugged a lot of the people that have been on your podcast and called them, Aaron Berger in particular. I gave him a phone call and asked him if he were me, what he'd do to try to grow in agriculture. And he told me to switch to sheep. And that was another thing that led me down getting rid of my cows and switching over to sheep completely. And so, you know, you've put a whole lot of really good resources out there and definitely exposed me to some things that have changed the way I think and then on top of that, you've spawned all these other podcasts, and those have had a big effect too. So I really appreciate you, and I appreciate you giving me a chance to talk.
Sure. Well, thank you for that. All glory to God for sure. It's just been me learning by asking people questions and hitting the record button so other people can learn with me. So it's been fun, and I'm not done yet. That's for sure. So thank you.
Yep.
Daniel, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Very good stuff there with Daniel. Really appreciate his perspective and the humility with which he talks about these things. Very much appreciate him taking the time to share some of his thoughts and some of the lessons he's been learning over the years. Really excited for part two of my discussion that we released as a bonus episode a couple weeks back with Burke Tykert. Of course, Burke is a wealth of knowledge, and we're going to pick up right where we left off, but we're going to get off into some EPD things and talking about some more granular level details of ranch management and how to do it successfully. And so really looking forward to sharing this conversation, part two of this conversation with Burke Tykert with you on the Working Cows podcast. After that, an episode that's been up on Patreon for a couple of weeks, actually. I released it early because there was some timely information there. But I have an episode with Don Day coming out, and maybe you know him, maybe you don't. He's an internet meteorologist, a private meteorologist is how he bills himself. And he just does some really good work as far as talking about weather patterns in the Western United States. And I heard him say something interesting a while back, quite a while ago now, on the Working Ranch radio show. And I don't know what the Venn diagram of those who listen to the Working Ranch radio show and those who listen to Working Cows podcast is, but I wanted to give him an opportunity to flesh that out for the audience of the Working Cows podcast and to update what he said there, because he talked a little bit about the long-term predictability of drought. And just as a little teaser for where that episode kind of lands, I even put the question to him kind of plainly and asked, do you think that these kind of trends are so predictable that we could plan to keep more cows around during this time and have fewer cows around during other times because the drought, we know that it's coming or we know that it's going to be past. And it's not as precise as, you know, on this calendar date or anything like that, but there are some really consistent trends that we could keep an eye on. So really look forward to sharing that episode with you. That'd be the next episode 302 that we'll release on a Monday, but coming this Friday is part two of my conversation with Burke Tykert, coming your way real soon on another episode of the Working Cows podcast. We'll see you then.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.